From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. On today's show, changing the narrative.
What is important is that people of color know that they are wanted. I don't know what gives me more pleasure, watching my story unfold or going in and watching a room full of black people talking for me and saying words and writing words that black people, I hate white people writing for black people. It's so offensive.
In just a moment, we'll hear from the conductor of an all-black orchestra in Atlanta who wants to increase diversity in classical music. And we'll talk to a photographer who honors the legacy of African-American women in her images. That's coming up this hour. But first, on yesterday's show, we heard from activist Cecily McMillan about her harrowing 57-day imprisonment at Rikers Island. This included the death of a fellow inmate.
Judith had succumbed to a coma by the time she was in the hospital and died from organ failure. Her sister would have never even known what had happened to her unless she had written, finally, Rikers to see if she was in there. She got a letter back that said, inmate no longer here. Not inmate went to the hospital and died. Inmate no longer here.
And here are your first thoughts. Douglas Hooker tweets, prisons are a closed door behind which we ignore the people and imagine them to be monsters. And Carrie Howell adds, bring back humanity in our prison system. Her tweet includes four crying emojis. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Less than 4% of musicians in American symphony orchestras are African American or Latino, and even fewer serve as CEOs or board members in orchestral organizations. So conductor Jason Rogers has founded a group in Atlanta called Orchestra Noir. The orchestra will feature all black musicians. Orchestra Noir will play their debut concert this Friday night in Atlanta at the Georgia Freight Depot. Celeste Headlee sat down with Jason Rogers back in March to talk a little about this new venture. She also spoke with Kane Thomason Reedus. He's the Director of Community and Learning for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And Celeste started off the conversation by asking Jason what he hoped to achieve as conductor of Orchestra Noir.
The central purpose is to provide professional African-American orchestra musicians with another opportunity to do what they were trained to do and be compensated for it.
Now, there are a number of organizations, such as the Sphinx Organization, that work to try to place African-American and Latino players within existing organizations. Is that sort of cross-purposes with what you're trying to do?
Yes. I mean, when you provide those opportunities, it bridges its way to other venues and other aspects and other ways to get these players with different organizations.
It sounds like you're saying that after they've played with you, that allows them to maybe get some of those other gigs with the L.A. Philharmonic, et cetera, et cetera. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, and not necessarily. This is really to provide them with opportunity to play here in Atlanta. And I mean, it's with the experience that they will gain here, I'm sure it will somehow transfer over to other aspects of playing in their professional career as well.
Kane, this is something that I know that the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and other orchestras have put a lot of time into trying to address for years. Why have we not solved this problem?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. There's you know, one thing is classical music is one of those fields where to succeed at the highest level that we're talking about, a professional symphony career, typically that's something that you've begun your training anywhere between the ages of 2 and 10, depending on the instrument and your own background. You know, that's an early start you have to have to be competitive. There are certainly people that get it done starting later in life, but it's much, much, much harder. So, you know, we're looking at the kind of numbers where you're comparing it to being a NASA astronaut or being in the NBA, and we're saying, why can't we get that number to go up? And we're also saying at the same time it's something that costs a lot of money that starts from early on, and you need a head start. You can't decide you want to do this in college. This is something you have to be working on from very early on. And this is at a time when arts education, music education specifically, are on the decline in public schools especially. So when you look at the way education is serving African American, Latino, Hispanic populations, they are being less served in terms of music in a field that requires more preparation. So as much as groups like the DSO, the Detroit Symphony here, the Sphinx Organization, all of Jason's work, as much as we are all trying to change that metric, it is a tough one, and it takes a lot of cooperation, a lot of investment.
How much a problem, Jason, is culture? Because I know from experience that for a number of people in both African-American and Latinos families, classical music is not part of a culture that they grew up in. And in some cases, they feel that that's part of a culture which is actually in clashes with their own.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, according to the statistic, 1% of the members of American professional orchestras are African-American. And I don't think that's due to discrimination, really, as most major orchestras have employed the blind audition.
Let me explain a blind audition. They're actually behind a screen. So the people listening to those auditions are one side of the screen, and they can't see the person who's playing.
Yep, that's right. And so I think really the main issue is exposure. Orchestras are still searching desperately to find a real concrete and definitive model for introducing classical music to the majority of the African-American community. And with the proper and adequate exposure, that will produce more African-American classical fans who would then put their children on instruments. And then we'll increase the number of African Americans playing on stage in those major symphonies in years to come.
And go ahead, finish your thoughts.
And really, the question is, the million-dollar question is, how do you expose? Well, you have to, of course, and orchestras have to incorporate the black composers, William Grant Still, like your grandfather, Florence B. Price, Scott Joplin, George Walker, who I actually had the privilege of playing for, great composer. But still, that's not enough. I think that orchestras forget that the majority of the black community, they have their own musical cultural heritage stemming from the African diaspora, jazz, Caribbean, more notably today, hip-hop, R&B. Orchestras have to find a way to get that, to get those genres played in the concert halls. And that's what Orchestra Noir is too, sort of that bridge, that Rosetta Stone.
Bringing in the new types of music. So,
yes.
I mean, Kane, the DSO is in kind of a similar position with Atlanta to a certain extent, in that you're talking about a city with a very large African-American population. But for a very long time, the DSO had one African-American player. Mm. So what do you think about this idea, Kane, then, of beginning an orchestra for just African-Americans, or maybe a different one that would only feature Hispanics? Could that help solve the problem?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. I mean, for me personally, I do not have a personal problem with culturally specific organizations like that, whether we're talking about African-American orchestras or Balkan dance groups or ballet folkloricos or whatever it is. If there's something that is seeking to bring culture to a particular group of people, especially if they've been excluded from it or just haven't been a part of it, I personally feel that's okay. I know there are people that take issue with that because they feel it in itself is another form of discrimination.
Segregation also.
Yeah. For me, it is different than that, because when you're looking at say the, you know, African American population being 13% of the country and 1% of orchestras, that points to a clear issue. And you know, when you are trying to fix something that we currently would call underrepresentation, mm-hmm. and is the result of decades of discrimination and segregation and exclusion and under-resources, mm-hmm. To me, it is attempting to fix the problem, and it does require some pretty serious measures. So I don't personally have a problem with it. Now, I think it's one of many things we need to do. I think having orchestras that are very culturally specific is just fine and great and beneficial and amazingly powerful for the people that participate in them and that observe them. I think it's important, though, that they reach an audience that is as broad as possible. Because one of the things that we also have to do is change the broad cultural perception of who classical music is for. One of the reasons that African Americans might feel excluded from classical music is because a lot of the people that currently perform and support and attend classical music don't see it as a priority, don't even honestly imagine that there could be an entire orchestra of African-American musicians. Mm-hmm.
You mean they don't think there's enough African-American musicians to fill an orchestra?
Absolutely. If you actually ask the question, are there enough, they would probably say no. But they wouldn't even think of the question in the first place. That would just seem nonsensical because it's, as you pointed out, Celeste, most orchestras around the country are similar to Atlanta and Detroit, where you've got one or two or maybe three African-Americans in the orchestra. So it's just
and they have a black conductor, but he or she conducts the youth symphony. That's generally
the
pattern.
Right, yeah. There'll be the resident conductor, the assistant conductor, and that's, you know, the conducting pipeline is just as rigorous and just as in need of some serious investment in the diversity aspect as well. Yes. And, you know, one thing that's different about us in music and in classical music, you know, if we were the medical industry, if we were the business industry, if we were the military, we wouldn't be allowed to be this segregatory, if that's not even a word. What am I saying?
I don't know if it is. I think you just invented it.
Yeah, I completely did. We wouldn't be allowed to be this homogenous, to lack diversity with this degree of severity. They've come up with pipeline programs. They have come up with ways to make their fields diverse, and these are with the most important fields held the closest to the heart of our country. When you talk about business, when you talk about medicine, when you talk about military, these are things that people care about more than just about anything else, and they have either been forced or they have created their own way to become more diverse, and certainly more can be done, but they're figuring out. If you can figure out a pipeline for black business leaders and black doctors, you can certainly figure out a pipeline for black orchestral musicians. Mm-hmm. It just has to be a priority. It has to have buy-in, and you have to show the benefit. We can't just say that we need black people playing music. You have to say why, and you have to say why is it a problem if they're not.
Mm-hmm. It's a thorny problem, but is the Orchestra Noir only, we only have about 30 seconds. Are you only going to be playing music by African-Americans and minorities, or are we going to hear some Beethoven and Bach?
We will hear some Beethoven and Bach. We will integrate that with hip-hop, R&B, and we will make the two come together very wonderfully.
That was Celeste Headlee speaking with Orchestra Noir conductor Jason Rogers back in March. Kane Thomason Reedus, the director of community and learning for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, also joined that conversation. And Orchestra Noir will make their debut this Friday night in Atlanta at the Georgia Freight Depot. More information about the concert is at gpbnews.org. Visual artist Ayanna Jackson likes to say that she fights photography with photography. She uses her lens to explore how images shape and construct African and African-American identities. Her images will be on display as part of the exhibit Africa Forecast, Fashioning Contemporary Life at the Spelman College Museum of Fine Arts in Atlanta. That opens today. She's also a Spelman grad. Ayanna Jackson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So it's tough to do photography on the radio, but I wonder if you couldn't pick an image that you think is a good introduction to your work and describe it for people.
Well, I guess it stands to reason that I would describe one of the works that's in the show. Mm-hmm. The works that I'm showing, there are two pieces from a series called Dear Sarah. That series is an homage to a woman named Sarah Forbes Benetta, a Dahomey West African woman who was essentially given as a gift to the Queen Victoria in the late 19th century. And the reason that I decided to pay homage to her is because she's one of the few early Victorian black women that was photographed, because Queen Victoria had a penchant for photography itself and had her photographed many times. It's a quite long story, but the essence of it is that as she was a black woman, African woman, who was raised as the goddaughter of Queen Victoria. But because she was essentially part of a transaction between the Queen and the Dahomey King at the time during Queen Victoria's kind of moment of trying to dismantle the slave trade after having, after the nation had already participated in it for several centuries. But as we know, England led a big proportion of the abolitionist movement. She adopted this young girl, but the thing is, she was this inanimate object. And so I sought to animate her through photography. So the two or three images of Sarah Forbes Spinetta are very stoic, very poised, very kind of inanimate. And so in these two works, I have her dancing, twirling in her wedding dress that was given to her by Queen Victoria.
And how did you do that? She's no longer around to photograph.
Well, a lot of my work appropriates images from the history of photography. So one thing that I think is important to acknowledge is that the birth of photography, which is the mid-19th century, is exactly at the same time as the colonial experiment. So the scramble for Africa by, like, you know, Western European countries. And so as this technology is becoming a part of or an appendage to these kind of movements, this appendage is being activated in spaces like sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and the Global South. And so, you know, for me, I think it's important to revisit those images, become literate in what they're saying, what they're communicating. And so even though she's no longer around, I choose to animate her and to activate her and to add depth and dimension to her narrative.
And you have a whole series of photos that you do where you recreate historical photographs, old daguerreotypes kind of things, some of them of your own ancestors, with yourself as model. In fact, you use yourself as model very, very frequently. Is that what you've done in this case?
Yes, I have. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing is, I come from a family, you know, I call ourselves up from slavery, but I also call ourselves founding fathers, because there are few communities in the United States that have been around as long as its, between quotes, founding.
Sure, yeah.
And so one of the things that, you know, I found in my family home were photographs from the late 19th century, photographs of my great-grandmother, Katie Clark Jackson, who gave birth to my grandfather in 1912, who herself was born in the 1890s, and who herself was also born to an enslaved black woman in the United States. And her portrait is situated in the Victorian kind of moment, you know, and so I felt that it was important for us to take some of these photographs from our private collections and bring them into the public, because much of the imagery that surrounds the black body, the African body, and the archive is taken from a moment of this kind of historical research that is, as I mentioned, related to the colonial experiment. And so how we've been taught to see the black body, how we've been taught to see the African body, has a lot to do with the political, the geopolitical kind of moments. But that does not, but we must remember that there are other moments when people of African descent, with their own agency, stepped into the portrait booth and created their own narratives and saw themselves, wanted to see themselves as they saw themselves. Right. So my work, my archival impulse, which is this title of the series that you mentioned, where I begin to recreate images from the archive, these old daguerreotypes, my particular impulse is to take those things out of the private and bring them to the public, to mix up what we understand in the collective image bank that is photography about
and
the
to bring
body.
Them into the present, right, through your own body.
Absolutely.
You are the present embodiment of your family line.
Absolutely. Yeah.
My guest is visual artist Ayanna Jackson. Her images are going to be on display as part of the exhibit Africa Forecast, Fashion and Contemporary Life at the Spelman College of Museum, Spelman College Museum of Fine Arts. And Ayanna, you did graduate from Spelman. You have family roots in Georgia, but you don't live here anymore. You live in South Africa, right?
I do. I live in Johannesburg.
Why did you make that choice?
Many reasons. The primary reason is actually that it made sense professionally. It's kind of a disconnect for many people to consider, you know, a U.S. American moving to Africa for opportunity, because the narrative, the prevailing narrative, is the other way around. But actually, there's a lot of infrastructure for photography, for fine art, in that place. And then beyond that, it's a minefield of things and inspiration for me. I mean, Johannesburg is a city that, as we all know, is busy becoming who it wants to be and what it wants to be. You know, it's coming out of a very disturbing history, and it has a very bright future ahead. But in this particular moment, it's fighting the tensions of tradition and modernity, of past and present. And so as an artist, I find it fascinating. Another layer to that, of course, is that I come from a family that absolutely, you know, my great-grandfather was a follower of Marcus Garvey. So I essentially come from a Garveyite family that absolutely, in a Black Star Line way, looked towards the continent as part of our conversation, our lineage, and our ancestry and our narrative. But Johannesburg specifically was more of a professional decision, and the continent of Africa was more of a family decision.
Right. Speaking of your family, I want to let people know that these images that we've been talking about, these photographs where you have recreated historical photographs of your own family using yourself as model, the phenomenal New York Times photography blog, The Lens, did a feature about you, and a lot of those images are reproduced there, and you could go ahead and find that right now. Again, the guest name is Ayanna Jackson. She's a photographer who has an exhibit, or is part of an exhibit at Spelman College, and you can find some of her work collected by the New York Times blog, The Lens. There's a photo, I think, from the same series that is going to be in the Spelman exhibit called "Does the Brown Paper Bag Test Really Exist? / Will My Father Be Proud?" Can you tell us about that?
Yes. That particular work is, it takes, as you mentioned earlier, I've been recreating photographs that actually exist. And as a Spelman grad, I've obviously spent time wandering the halls of and the archives of our institution, which was founded in 1881 and is named for Laura Spelman Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And so there are
And I should say that the Spelman Museum is the only museum in the country that emphasizes art by and about women of the African diaspora. It's a pretty special place.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for saying that. I can't even begin to discuss how proud I am to return to these corridors and to be displayed on the walls of that museum, which was inaugurated during my tenure as a student, during my period as a student there. But that particular photograph is based on one of the early graduating classes of at Spelman. The title is, and so in that, for the listeners, in that photograph, I represent each of the, I think there are about five or six women in that photograph, so I replicate all of them. I'm dressed in Victorian, in the clothing of, well, it is Victorian era, the clothing of the period, so you have this kind of corseted waists and these bellowing shoulders and very high collars and different hairstyles, natural hair, but that's been kind of tied in buns and women sitting on the floor and women sitting in chairs. But the title is called "Does the Brown Paper Bag Test Really Exist?" And what's interesting about Spelman's legacy as a school for women of color is that that for many years, in a very between, quote, dark period, one had to be lighter than a brown paper bag to be able to attend Spelman College. It was only photographically, if you look at the archive, it was much later before you started to see women that were my complexion and darker in mass at the school. So one thing that, not to really go there and derail my alma mater, but in thinking about that notion of the brown paper bag test that existed all over the South, which absolutely had to do with one's age, one's ability, and one's mobility, rather, socially and economically. How does a African descendant of the slave trade become lighter than a brown paper bag? Well, it has to do with the mixing. How often, not that there were not unions of love, which I think deserve their moment in history. But mm-hmm. there was also a significant amount of sexual abuse and rape. Sure. And so the reason that it has these two titles, Does the Brown Paper Bag Test Really Exist? And Will My Father Be Proud? Is wondering if these young girls, you know, I guess to back up, the reason it has two titles is one is in the imagined voice of the photographer, does it exist? And the second title is in the imagined voice of the sitter, Will My Father Be Proud? So these young girls are wondering if their father is acknowledging this incredible achievement of having been able to graduate from university in 1881.
Ayanna Jackson is a visual artist. Her images are going to be on display as part of the exhibit Africa Forecast, Fashion and Contemporary Life at the Spelman College Museum of Fine Arts in celebration of the museum's 20th anniversary. Ayanna, you have a very, very striking, very disturbing, very powerful image that's part of your portfolio in which you are again the subject and you are nude and you've been lynched. Tell us about this.
That work is titled Death, and it comes, it's one of the last works that I made in a series called Poverty Pornography that addressed the prevalence of images of death, disaster, disease, and destruction with regard to the black body, whether it's African or diaspora. Again, as it was mentioned in the introduction, I've decided to address and or fight photography with photography. When I came across the photographs that perhaps some of your listeners are familiar with, of lynchings. I mean, there was a period in the after the turn of the century and into the 30s where one could not only attend a public lynching of black bodies, predominantly male bodies, but there were women as well, but they could be photographed in attendance, and then that photograph would be made or could be made into a postcard, which could then be mailed around. And there was an exhibition not long ago of these postcards, so it's not as rare or as unknown as one would think. And so I was quite disturbed by the fact that this kind of imagery was not only encapsulized in an image, in a piece of paper as a document, but also became a piece of publicity. So that series where I recreate the lynching as a nude woman, it has to do with, I wanted to create a metaphor for the seductive and repulsive nature of that kind of imagery. So with nudity, for those of us who come, you know, I was raised Catholic, and so for those of us who come from a Judeo-Christian narrative, we have a very kind of bizarre relationship to nudity, right? It's like we want to see, but we don't want to see. We have the Adam and the Eve story where Adam and Eve are shamed into putting clothes on. So this kind of tension is very prevalent, and it's and has existed through the centuries, right? And so for me, images of death and disaster and disease and you kind of Sally Struthers, for those of us who remember the 80s.
Well-meaning white people like me going to Africa and taking pictures of deprivation and poverty with the best of intentions.
But ultimately those
images can be problematic in the same way that a more malicious image like a celebratory photo of a lynching can be.
Precisely. And so, but the thing is, for me, you know, at the same time that this is happening in my family, for instance, in a slight tangent, but I'll come back very quickly. You know,
we have 1 minute.
My family, we have a house in Ghana, and so our Ghanaian cousins would come, and you know, my Uncle Simone would come dressed in his like normal outfits of the 90s, and so there was this kind of, I didn't understand why all I knew from the television was swollen belly children with flies around their eyes, yet there's this, you know, contemporary black African man that's in my house. So, but why wasn't that something that I was privy to? So, and I felt that maybe it had to do with the fact that these other images are more seductive. Much like pornography, it's like we would rather see what's illicit and what separates us, or maybe even reaffirms our, what's the word? 32 seconds, our contemporaneity, our kind of Western civilized, between quotes, self from that. So there's this almost gratification from being able to look at someone else's deprivation. And that seduction and repulsion, that tension is what I want to replicate.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm so sorry. Ayanna Jackson is a photographer. She's part of the exhibit Africa Forecast, Fashion and Contemporary Life at the Spelman College Museum of Fine Arts. Please go see it. And we have photos at gpbnews.org. Do facts still matter? I should hope so, considering our business, but a new book warns that society has devolved into shouting matches rather than polite discourse about our differences. On tomorrow's show, the Break Room Gang talks about living in a post-fact world, along with other topics. And we want to know what you think. Call us at 404-594-57 to be part of this discussion, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Our next conversation is with a man who has influenced countless songwriters and singers, William Bell. He's a singer, a songwriter, a producer. He's been based out of Atlanta since 1970. He released his first album in 40 years back in June. It's called This Is Where I Live. He will perform tonight in Atlanta at the City Winery. Celeste Headlee spoke with William Bell back in February. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
So tell me what it's like when a number of your songs have been covered by other artists, and some of them have sounded nothing like the original. And you probably know the one I'm thinking of, which is Billy Idol did a version of Forgot to Be Your Lover. So what is that like? Do you think that in a cover like that, because there's been a number, even Otis Redding covered one of your songs. There's been a whole bunch of people who've covered your songs that you did originally. What is that like when they make substantial changes to your song? Is that bothersome?
And no, it isn't, you know, because I like for an artist to, individuality is what makes an artist, and I like for an artist to be an artist. Sometimes it takes me a minute to really process how they heard a certain, like Billy Idol, he took a ballad, a sensitive ballad, and made it the up-tempo thing, but he actually identified with the lyrical content and everything, and he made it his, which was great. And of course, I can't argue with the success of it. So, but I love for an artist to take something that I've created or written and make it theirs. You know,
did you and he have a conversation about it ever?
No,
either
not
before
ever.
He recorded it or after? Never.
Never. I got a copy of it from the label before they released it. And when I first got the copy, they were asking what I thought about it. And I said, well, I'm going to hold my opinion for a minute and let me live with it for a while. So after 3 or 4 days, I kind of got it and I called them back. I said, great.
But it took you 3 or 4 days.
Yeah,
so that must have been shocking.
It really did, because I'm going, okay, how did he hear this? That lyrical part of this. And it took me a minute to get it. Yeah.
So that brings us to the issue of sampling, which your music has also been sampled a lot. And I wanted to play you a comment from Snoop Dogg. You were part of a documentary called Take Me to the River, where they paired younger artists with some of the veterans. And you actually were paired with Snoop Dogg. And he said some interesting things. Here's one of them.
My grandparents and my mother, and they inspired me by playing this good music when I was young, you know, to turn me on to it, to hit me to it, and to make me love it. It's a respect thing. Hip-hop is the dominant music right now. So I say that to say this. When those brothers take the time out of their careers to say, we want to dedicate this song and this title to somebody who inspired us, who wasn't a hip-hop artist, respect that.
I wonder if that's how you feel about sampling. Do you hear it as respect?
I do. I do. Anytime an artist can find something that I've created that they can relate to and bring it up to fit their generation, I do have respect for that. There are a lot of writers and performers that don't like that, but it doesn't bother me, I guess, because I'm also into the creative process. And when an artist comes forth with a totally original take on something that I've done, I like it. I mean, it's cool.
Okay. Not every artist is great at writing music for other people. And those who write well for other people aren't always so great at writing for themselves. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
Many people write songs for themselves that they can sing, but they don't translate to any other. You're nodding your head, so you know exactly what I mean.
Yes.
How do you, is that a skill that you have to learn, or is that something you're just either born with or not?
Well, it's a process to where if you're going to write a song, I write about life, and hopefully that people identify with it. My lyrical content is all about life. I try to gear my melodies so that they're easily recognizable. But if I write specifically for another artist, I try to get inside that artist's persona. You know.
How do you do that, though?
Well, you talk with the artist, or you listen to his past history of performances or what he's about, or try to read up on him or her, and how their life has evolved, and you write about that. You know, like in writing for, say, Albert King, I knew that he didn't read or write, so inclusive in that song, I wrote a lyric about I can't read, didn't learn how to write. And these were things that he could identify with as an artist.
Do you find that that gets a more emotional performance out of them? What difference does it make when you're putting things in there that they can instantly relate to?
Yeah, that does touch them emotionally, because if there's something that you can relate to, you can easily, readily get into it. As there are a lot of people that hear a song and say, oh, God, I could have written that if I was a writer, because that's my life. And so they readily identify with it. So emotionally, they are more drawn to it if it's something that they can identify with lyrically.
So let's talk about you as a singer instead of a songwriter for just a moment. And let's hear a little bit to your performance in the White House. President Obama and Michelle Obama sitting right in front of you. This is 2014. And let's hear a little bit. You were singing probably one of your best known songs, You Don't Miss Your Water.
In the beginning, you really loved me, and I was too blind, and I couldn't see.
And Booker T on the keyboards.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than
no.
that. And, of course, it was like old home week with Booker and Sam and Eddie and all the gang there from Stax and some of the musicians. It was just great. And you're performing for the president. I mean,
how do you not choke
do you go
up?
From the right? Well, you know, I'm comfortable on stage, and I try, and as long as I know that the musicians are comfortable and vocally I'm good to go, I'm comfortable on stage. I didn't really get nervous or anything with that. Probably a little apprehensive, because when you're going into a situation where you said, okay, this is the top dignitary of the world.
And the first African-American president in the United States.
Yeah, so it's historical and everything
else. Oh, it's
a
moment.
Yeah, so all of that, but you process it, and when you get on stage, you put that behind you and go for the performance.
You know, I wonder what you think about some of the current methods we have of identifying talent. And by that, I mean, your story to a certain extent is kind of iconic, right? I mean, you came up singing in the church and then kind of hard scrabbled your way, that you have a long history of really hard work and just sort of hustling to get where you were. And so when you watch like American Idol or some of the competition choice of shows, The Voice or the X Factor, is there a ideal way to identify talent? Is it better to like have someone discover it, or is it better when somebody has to really work for it?
Well, I think real talent, authentic talent, I think is a gift. You can hone it, hone the craft, you can learn more about the process of it, but the actual talent is really a gift that to be cherished. I like The Voice the way they do. They turn around and...
Because they're blind auditions.
Yeah, it's a blind audition. You're totally listening for the interpretation, the vocal range, and all of that. You don't care about the look right at this moment. You're listening for that signature sound, that voice, and how they interpret a lyric and how heartfelt it is. And so that's, to me, very important.
So weigh in a little bit on some of the other discussions we're having, especially around soul music, because there's a lot of arguments over appropriation of soul music and when it's appropriate for an artist to sing it and when it isn't. Did you ever have those kind of thoughts about soul music that comes out of your personal experience, or soul music that is part of your background as a young African American, especially when you're writing some of these things, and whether or not it's then appropriate for a white artist or someone else to come in and then sing that piece of music?
I don't have any apprehensions about it. I think if they can relate to it, great. Like I said, I write about life. I write about personal experiences, some things from observation. And even if I just take a hypothetical situation and write about it, I try to write it in such a way that I think the ordinary lay person can identify with it. You know, so when a person can take a piece of music or something and do that, I don't have any problems with that. You know, it's like... I'm good with it.
So I wonder, I mean, you're talking about world music and how widespread music is, and it is. It's readily available. I can hear something from, you know, Bangladesh if I feel like it. Has that removed some of our characteristics of different regions? Do we still, for example, have a southern sound anymore?
We do. We definitely, it's funny because you asked that. I heard Uptown Funk as
performed by Bruno Mars.
Yeah, but Boo Mitchell was a part of that. I didn't know at the time, but he's in the film with me. So we were riding from Austin to Dallas in a car, and the record came on. Instantly, I knew that was a Memphis record. And I'm going, I didn't know who it was because the first time I had heard it, I'm going, hold on, guys, who is that? And he said, oh, that's the record that we cut on Bruno Mars. That's Uptown Funk.
What did you hear?
There's a certain sound, a drum sound that High Records has that it's undeniable. You know, it's like all that Al Green stuff and all. That sound I told Boo, you should just lock that into a gold cage and keep it there. And he does. He just locks up. He never takes the drums down.
Or moves them,
anything. He'll lock the drum booth after everybody does a session, you know. But there's just something about the sound and the feel of the musicians when they're cutting in certain regions that you just recognize it.
So do we have an Atlanta? I mean, you've been in Atlanta for decades now. Is there an Atlanta sound then?
You know what? I don't hear an Atlanta sound. And the reason being, you have great studios, great musicians here. But there's no one entity like a group of musicians that cut enough together to establish that particular feel. So you always incorporate a lot of different musicians and talent when you go into a recording session. They get hit records out of it, but they don't establish that signature sound like out of New Orleans
or Detroit or
Muscle Shoals or something. Or
but one of the things that makes, I know Detroit quite well, one of the things that makes their sound so recognizable is because they have the same group of like 100 musicians who play on everything.
Right.
Punk,
yeah.
Techno, everything. And you'll walk in and you'll see the same guy that played on the country song.
Absolutely.
So maybe we don't have that here in Atlanta.
We do not have that here in Atlanta. It's not musicians are more individualized here. Great musicians, but individualized. Whereas you have what I call cliques of musicians, sets of musicians that play on everything over at like Stax Records or over at High Records or down in New Orleans, you know, and so you establish that sound. They play enough together to where they just read each other's minds. And you had that for a long time out in California back in the 60s, early 60s, with a lot of those musicians and played on everything.
Yes. It's true. Playing on Soul Records, playing on the Beach Boys, same cats.
Absolutely.
All right, so before we go, what's on your playlist? What are you listening to?
Everything from classical to pop to country, because that's me. I've listened to everything my whole life. When I was a kid, I was listening to the Four Freshmen and Sam Cooke and You name it. I mean, well, Nat
we're
Cole.
Losing. I mean, we are aging a whole generation of incredible musicians. When I think about those like yourself who are getting older and Bill mm-hmm. Withers and this whole generation of people who just defined a moment in music, is there anybody rising up to sort of take that mantle on, or are we just set that sort of era in soul music aside?
I think there are some good artists out there. They haven't reached their peak yet, so you don't, they're not household names. Yeah, but John Legend, I think, will be around for a minute. I think a long time, because he has a signature sound and he's a great writer and everything. I think he's going to be here for a while. Ed Sheeran is going to be here, of course, even with her sound is more popish, but Taylor Swift will be around for a while because she's a good writer. And there are a lot of other artists. I'm missing a lot of them, but there are some up-and-coming new talent that really has it going on, got it going on, and they're going to be here for a while. It's just it takes time to establish their niche within the industry.
And maybe find their voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been speaking with singer-songwriter William Bell. It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
That was soul singer William Bell. He spoke with Celeste Headlee back in February. His new album is called This Is Where I Live, and he will play tonight in Atlanta at the City Winery. More information about the event is available at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. Tomorrow, we'll speak with the organizer of Music Midtown in Atlanta. This year's headliners are The Killers, Beck, and Deadmau5. What do you think about that lineup? Will you attend this year? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Have a good one. I want to be It's not that easy to forget all the love you had, and looking back on the man I was makes the man I am so sad.